Marin at 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning's Edition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives and the self-righteous. And how are you, good working people of America, this morning? Wake up, sheeple, at 6 past. I'm Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley. You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. If you're listening in New York City, you're probably listening to WLIV 1190. Some of you might not be waking up because a lot of people, I guess, went to the 12 o'clock showing of this new Star Wars movie, Riley. 12 o'clock. When was the last time you went to a midnight movie, Riley? Exactly. Yeah, you can't even remember. I think I was 15.
Purple Rain.
But people were lining up. The geeks were lining up. The Star Wars crazies were lining up in their outfits and their costumes. I'm a little out of whack. I don't know what the hell's going on. I missed the last two. Apparently, there's a problem in outer space. Does that make me backward? Is it weird?
No. The last time I went to a midnight movie, they were selling marijuana in the aisles.
Exactly. That's, I mean, I was in high school. We used to go see Pink Floyd at the wall.
Girls. Yeah.
I actually remember going to see the Magical Mystery Tour as a midnight movie. But dig this. Some Republican critics are accusing this as being a political movie, that Lucas is planting politics in his movie. God forbid someone make a piece of art that actually has some significance, that actually reflects on the current state of affairs. Yeah, that's a real problem. Remember when that was what art was supposed to do?
Yeah, you know
what I mean? Isn't that the idea? Is to put a little thing, and what they're basing it on is a line in the movie where the Darth Vader warns, "If you're not with me, you're my enemy." All right, so they're saying, "Hey, that's Bush, man. He's hacking Bush. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists." That's what he's saying. I hate to tell you, but I think this idea, this line, has been with human beings since the beginning of warfare. And if Lucas is making a criticism of the current administration, God bless him for doing that. Remember the 70s? Remember when movies were actually, you know, sort of, some of them were auteurs making dark sort of statements about what was going on in Vietnam? And Lucas even says that when I thought of this, America was in Vietnam and the parallels are staggering.
Well, yeah, and I could just hear the Darth Vader theme behind Bush going out to a press conference or something. I mean, look, these folks are so paranoid about popular culture that any negative reference to the Bush administration and to their agenda, more importantly, is going to be met with this kind of nonsense.
They're babies. And what makes me more upset is this guy Peter Seeley, a former marketing chief at Columbia Pictures. All right, he basically says that the other filmmakers and marketers might do well to inspect their pictures for latent political messaging before the public does it for them. You know, whatever Lucas may have said, let there be controversy. MoveOn.org is using some of the new Star Wars in an advertisement, you know, against Frist, which I think is brilliant. Why not? The truth of the matter is we cannot, you know, self-censor ourselves. It's one thing to be aware, but I'm sure that George Lucas was aware. And what are they going to do? Stop Star Wars from making money? Please. And anybody who's sitting there making lists of movie stars and actors and Hollywood people to boycott because of their political views are anti-American.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The Drudge Report actually compared the White House press corps to the Sith. Not George W. Bush. Now, this is after, of course, the White House press corps kind of went after, I guess, Drudge's boy, Scott McClellan, for that foolishness around Newsweek. But, you see, again, it all becomes wrapped up in both media and popular culture, which aren't always the same thing. But you see that folks are ridiculously thin-skinned, the thing that they accuse progressives of being most of the time.
Yeah. Well, here's another thing that upsets me, is this guy, this former Republican, what's his name?
Tobin,
who was up in Maine, who was accused of tampering or planning to tamper with phone lines. To tamper with the Democrats' campaign, and he's pleaded innocent, all right? But he's in the questioning of a jury. He wants to question whether or not people are Democrats. And if they are Democrats, they ask you a lot of questions. You were just on jury duty yesterday, Riley.
Yep.
They ask you a lot of questions about what you watch, what you listen to, who you are, kind of. And then he wants to say that people who are Democrats have a bias against them, and they can't sit on a jury. These guys want to draw party lines in every area of culture and American life. They want it to be a civil war all the time. Democrat, doesn't matter if you're Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, Independent. As an American, as somebody who is a functioning part of this democracy on a civic level, you should be able to sit on a jury and make a decent judgment. That it's a jury of your peers. That means any American who is not biased in the ways that, you know, family members or sat on a case before accused of a crime. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't matter. It's not about partisan politics when it comes to being a member, a peer, in judging on a jury.
Well, this guy went even further, Tobin, you know. He wants the grand jury indictment against him thrown out because he said there were Democrats on the grand jury. Now, that's happening. So he wants to grant. Now, grand juries are usually 23, 24 people. He wants 24 Republicans to decide whether or not there was probable cause to indict him for committing a crime?
Who's being biased?
That's insane. That's not just bias. That's nuts.
Yeah, it's just, it's wrong to draw these kind of lines because it's a democracy. There are two parties. This is one of the reasons why the filibuster is important. When you have a majority, you have to protect the minority. That checks and balances. That's the way this government is supposed to work. It's the way the government was designed for this country, and it's one of the last hopes that will function properly. When you get idiots like this, you know, partisan hacks who are criminals, who are thugs, who set out to sabotage an election process, then saying he doesn't want Democrats on his jury because they're biased, again, anti-American. So dig this. If you're in the office and your computer melts down, and then the guys next to you melts down, and no one knows where it came from, be sure you go down the hall and give the IT guy a donut, because apparently there's a poll out that says that disgruntled workers are the most likely saboteurs. That's the reason. It's not some sort of mysterious worm that comes from outside of the world. It's not a computer problem. It's because somebody pissed off the IT guy.
Well, I hope they're not pissing off our IT guy, because we'll be destroyed around here, man. But
this place destroys itself, naturally. We cannot have it having any help.
But, you know, what I think this study is pointing out is that IT guys live in a world of their own that most of us have no idea or understanding of. So if they get mad, it's easy for them to sabotage everybody, and nobody's going to be able to trace it back to them anyway.
Be nice to the IT guy.
Be real nice.
I'm sure there were a few out there last night. They're probably tired. They were up till 3 in the morning with their lightsabers online. So anyway, moving on.
Speaking of Wait a minute now. I'm not going to have Mike Borges, our IT guy, doing it.
Oh, wait, let's see this. Vanessa, listening in Sacramento, says she went to the movie last night. You saw Star Wars. What's up?
Hi. Yeah. I wanted to call you guys because I'm never up at this hour. It's, you know, sometime after 3 a.m. here, and I just got out of the movie like 10 minutes ago. They're actually showing it like every 10 minutes.
Really?
Every 10 minutes, like until 6 in the morning.
How was it?
It was really good. I was really impressed. I'm not the geek. It's actually my husband.
Is he taking his costume off right now?
No.
He got a lightsaber, though, doesn't he?
I think his parents had them at their house, and they actually got rid of him. He was very upset about that. Actually, I was disappointed. There weren't as many costumes as I thought there would be. I wanted to take pictures, but we didn't see anybody. There were a few lightsabers in there, though.
Did you sense a political tone to the film?
Oh, absolutely. And I loved it. I thought it was great. I kept poking my husband every time something came up because we had heard about it. Mm-hmm. But, oh, yeah, there's like this liberal agenda. And I was like, no.
Liberal agenda in a good way, Vanessa?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I loved it. It was like there's the line that you mentioned earlier where, you know, The future Darth Vader says, if you're not with us, you're against us, kind of thing. And Obi-Wan answers back, only the Sith talk in absolutes. They're like the evil ones. And who do we know that talks in absolutes?
Terrific.
The Republicans? Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling, Vanessa.
Thanks, Vanessa.
Nice talking to you. Well, liberal agenda or not liberal agenda, a critique of warfare is not unusual in, you know, art form going back to Homeric times. I mean, to even pre-Homeric times. I mean, this shouldn't be a partisan agenda. This is human activity. And if the art doesn't reflect, you know, what is going on in the world, even if it's popular art, it really becomes sort of just banal entertainment. And there's the fear that I have, Riley, in all of this, is that people that do have political minds and political creativity are going to start censoring themselves out of fear. I think that statement from that guy from Columbia Pictures, Seeley, is not so much censoring. It's saying that If you put something in there, get ready to own it. And I think that's what Lucas did. I think in a, you know, what we need to talk about next is Latinos in politics. Bloomberg, we have a mayor in Los Angeles who just won in
first
a landslide.
First Latino mayor since the 1870s.
And Bloomberg is you know, making himself very appealing to the minority community here in New York City. So we'll get into that next here on Air America Radio.
Join the Morning Sedition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Past the hour, Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. Good morning. If you're listening to Air America in New York City, you're listening to 1190 WLIB. Kalo, our board op, Kalo the Costco ho, made a good point. Why didn't my wife go to the Star Wars movie?
Yeah, she's a huge Star Wars fan.
Well, see, I think she was waiting till Friday. Oh, you know what? I think I'm going to be seeing it this Friday.
Really? Uh-oh.
I think I'm going to have to go to the 10 in the morning showing. So look, Riley, this is big news. Villaraigosa. Antonio Villaraigosa, the new mayor of Los Angeles, the first mayor, the first Hispanic mayor of Los Angeles since it was a Spanish mission city.
Yes, of 6,000. That was back, I believe, in 1872.
So this is profound. Lou Dobbs must be freaking out.
Well, he's freaking out. But, I mean, look, Antonio Villaraigosa has a very interesting background. And you know, if you want to talk about somebody who pulled himself up by his bootstraps or however you want to describe it, he grew up in East L.A., you know, his father left, but he managed to go to high school, college. He went to UCLA, then went to law school, became a member of the California Assembly, you know, has really gone up the ladder and had lost the last election against the incumbent mayor, Han. But this time he cobbled together a very interesting coalition that included a majority of the black vote, which he did not get 4 years ago when he ran the first time. And he managed not just to win the election, he creamed this guy. It was like 58-42.
Well, this is an amazing thing that, you know, it's nice to see Democratic alignment in the minority community again, you know, especially because we hear that there's a fragmenting of, you know, his Latinos and black voters that, you know, some are going over to the Republican side for reasons that are, you know, baffling to me. Now, what the interesting thing is, how does this reflect on the New York City mayoral race, Riley? Because you follow this. You've known these guys for years. You've known Mayor Bloomberg for years. You've known Farrar for years.
Freddie Ferrer. Sure. Who was a Puerto Rican candidate for mayor here in New York City. And a lot of people that have seen what has gone on in L.A. are looking and asking whether or not Fernando Ferrer can cobble together the same kind of black-Latino coalition that Antonio Villaraigosa was able to do successfully. Now, Freddie Ferrer, like Villaraigosa, ran for mayor actually twice before. Lost both times. He dropped out in 97, lost in 2001 in a hotly contested runoff. But one of the things that you're seeing take place here, Mark, is an evolution. Latino voters, because of their immigration status, in some instances, don't vote in the numbers that their population would suggest. For example, in L.A., 47% of the population is Latino, but Latinos only comprise 25% of the voting population. So there's a gap there, and that's true in New York as well.
Uh-huh.
That's why a lot of people have, up until now, taken the Latino vote for granted, because even though the numbers in the population were high, the numbers who voted were much lower.
Right.
Well, that's starting to change as you get more and more people who are of Latino parentage but born in the States, born in L.A., born in New York. These folks are coming up, and they are, in fact, voting. They are Puerto Rican American, Mexican American, Dominican American. They're starting to vote in larger numbers, which means that the Latino population is growing among the total number of voters. For example, in 2000, here in New York, the black population is 2.3 million. The Latino population is 1.7 million.
Mm-hmm.
That is a huge, huge force, and no one who runs for elected office here can afford to ignore it. The Asian population is growing. It's almost at 500,000 at this point. So you see that the idea of cobbling together these ethnic coalitions, which a lot of people, a lot of the pundits here in New York, I think, and in L.A., thought that in the 21st century, ethnic politics would end up being a thing of the past. even though, for example, here in New York, there used to be this old political saying that, you know, you couldn't win without visiting the three I's, Israel, Ireland, and Italy. That was how ethnic politics worked throughout most of the 20th century.
So now the paradigm is just shifting in terms of the cultures that are being represented in these ethnic communities.
Absolutely. That and the increased number of ethnics who are voting.
Yeah.
Ethnics of color.
Well, that's interesting because those are the first generation immigrants. It makes perfect sense. This is the new wave of immigrants and their families, and now we're seeing the, almost a third generation, certainly, of Latinos, as you were saying.
Yeah.
And Asians have been here for many years, but that community has become very diverse. So mayors and anyone running for elected office has to put together these coalitions. That's interesting. And also, it seems today there are reports that the standardized testing results for people of Latino and the Latino community and the black community in fourth grade up amazing
10%, the highest percentage increase since they started these tests.
And you know, Bloomberg's going to take credit for that.
Well, it's a big plus for him.
Sure.
He told New Yorkers, judge me by what I do on education, and this might as well be a campaign slogan because it's going to resonate from now until the general election in November.
That's a, oh my God.
Whoa!
Oh, you know, Chewbacca was here yesterday, and I don't believe it. Look, it's Yoda. Look,
what?
He's walking in the room slowly.
Oh, my God.
Hey, let
okay.
me help him on the chair. Hold on.
You okay?
Yeah, you all right?
You all right, man?
How are you?
Ooh, well, I am.
Well, I am.
Help you out? I can.
Now, there's been a lot of talk, Yoda, about this being a political movie.
Ooh, biased this movie is not.
But some Republicans are very upset.
Oh, where could these bastards be? Nothing but haters these bitches are.
So, but you're saying that you don't play partisan politics, and the movie doesn't either.
Well, Hillary, 2008.
thank you for stopping by, Yoda. It's important.
Hillary's campaign thanks him too. I'm sure.
It's nice that she has Yoda on. She'll be.
Can we record that and put it in the instant replay?
Yeah, in 2008.
Yes, we can. Thank you. It's nice that they're stopping by, that they make the time for Air America Radio, because a lot of Democrats don't. Democrats.
We'll get into that too.
The politicians. So next, we'll be talking about some generals who are saying mixed messages about the success of the Iraq War.
Yeah, and we're also going to talk about someone's plan for Ground Zero and the birth date of an icon here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio. Coming soon from the people who brought you the shadow government, Detective Mark Maron faces his greatest challenge yet, the religious right. Solving an ancient mystery, following a cold trail, and trying to interrogate televangelists who will only answer in tongues.
Better tell me who's behind this, Tilton, or it'll go rough for you.
It was. I attached my
How do I know you're not lying?
Starting May 26th, Morning Sedition presents Mark Maron and the Temple of Doom.
Well, I'll be damned.
Yes, Mark, you certainly will.
Tune in May 26th or go to hell.
34 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo!
It's Morning Sedition on Air America. Good morning, folks. If you're listening in the New York area, you're listening to 1190 WLIB. We got a report here. There's been several briefings and interviews with several generals and high-level, high-ranking officials. Is that what you call them? Officers and officials.
Yes, high-ranking officers and officials who don't want their names on the record for fear of whatever.
And this is on the front page of the New York Times, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of mixed messages coming out of their assessments of Iraq. Some of them are saying that we can have the troops out, you know, within 6 months. Is that what one of them said? And then another guy said, we can still fail here. And, of course, that guy goes without being named. It's hit or miss. They're still having some trouble, you know, getting Iraqi national security forces, Iraqi police forces to engage fully. One of them said that there was a plan to have Iraqi officials, Iraqi officers, you know, making these briefings, but they're yet to find any that are willing to step up and do that.
Well, no, and they're not going to find anybody for the near future because you might as well put a target on your back. Remember that now we've got this huge increase in the number of car bombs up until about 2 or 3 days ago. And what you're seeing, Mark, is the generals on the one hand who just a few weeks ago were, the elections have taken place and everything seems to be working well and it looks like we've got our handle around this insurgency, and now suddenly some of the same people, I hate to say this, are saying, gee, you know, maybe we were a little over-optimistic when we said just a couple of weeks ago that these things are working out. The step up in the insurgency, whether it's from Zarqawi, whether it's from Osama bin Laden somewhere on the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, wherever it's coming from, the insurgency has stepped up and American generals were not prepared for it, number one. And number two, you know, that Operation Matador, they said they went out and they engaged the insurgents and they killed X number of insurgents. And we had a guest the other week who said, you know, I hate it when I hear these body counts because it really means we're losing. And look at what they're saying now.
That's unbelievable. I mean, it's not unbelievable in who we have talked to over a period of time, the people we've talked to on the ground in Iraq, the people who have showed us the nature of the insurgency, the people that understand that what's being fought there is a civil war and a true guerrilla war. And the truth of the matter is we haven't got, the Americans have not managed to get the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people in mass at all. And most of the people who are involved in the Iraqi police, the Iraqi National Security Force, are terrified for reprisals from their own people.
500 dead in 2 weeks.
Unbelievable. As we said, a study sponsored by Department of Homeland Security has found that corporate insiders who sabotage computers and networks are motivated mainly by anger against their bosses, your IT guys. So if something goes on with your computer, if there's a meltdown, if some strange porn shows up, if something is missing, there's a chance that it might be the guy down the hall who you might not treat so well. So today is Get Your IT Guy a Donut Day. We got a guy on the phone who takes issue with this story. Rocco, listening in New Paltz. Good morning.
Hey, what's up, Rocco?
Hi, guys. Thanks for the show. It's really great. So I take issue with that. Most of the times I find the problem with most computers is a loose nut between the keyboard and the chair.
Are you the user?
Are you an IT guy?
Yeah.
Okay.
I've been one for 15 years.
Now, do people treat you nicely?
Well, you know, when you come over to their computer and they're in panic mode because they lost something and you've recovered for them, you are always your friend.
Okay.
You know?
And when are they not your friend, Rocco?
When are they not your friend?
Yeah.
When you don't get there right away.
There you go.
A lot of them expect you to, you know, drop whatever you're doing sometimes and just, you know, oh, my computer's broke.
Do they all honor your power and know that you are the master of their universe?
I wouldn't say that, but they do have some respect for me.
Now, Rocco, I gotta ask you this question. Have you ever wanted to disable the computer or someone who just, like, really, you know, ate at you all day?
Well, I've wanted to disable computers of people who say that they can't do their work when they can manage to change around their screensaver and all other matter of things on their computer.
So you're saying they don't learn the skills to actually do what they need to get done?
No,
and work
they know
on.
The skills. They just don't want to work.
Oh, you're saying they like you. But Rocco, this study is talking about stuff that the average, you know, computer dunce, like me, for example, could not do if you put a Glock to our head.
But there's stuff on the internet now that hasn't been out there called spyware.
Yeah.
And the user like you could, and I see this every day, a user like you could click on a link that says, oh, your computer has spyware on it.
I think you lost him at link.
Yeah.
You could click
What's a link?
On a website, okay?
What's a website?
I'm only kidding,
Rocco. I'm
and
sorry.
It will say, your computer's broken. Do you want us to fix it? And that site will more than likely be installing some piece of software that's going to track where you've been on the internet.
Right. Did you see that moment, though, where Rocco was like, come on. You know, like, you're like, he was being patient. He was being a good IT guy and entertaining your ignorance, Riley.
I know.
And then there was a
and
moment
And then I became
there,
his worst nightmare.
I felt the wrath of Rocco.
Rocco, you can't get at my computer, pal.
Thanks for calling, buddy.
Thanks, Rocco.
You take care. So that's the truth.
I'll tell you what, if he could, he probably would.
Is there any calls, other calls there, Chris?
Yeah. I think there's a couple.
Actually, yeah, Future Mark's over on line one.
Future Mark, great. Put him through.
Hey, buddy, what's up?
Hey, buddy, what's up? So what's going on in 2050 today?
Well, I'm getting my kidney replaced. It's been about 3 months, and I was at the hospital anyway, so I thought, you know, what the hell? But that's not really why I'm at the hospital.
So why are you at the hospital?
Well, I'm a little down. You know, I'm kind of in a mood. You know, I had to bring my clone in because he hurt himself.
Oh, no. Is he, are they okay? I mean, are you guys okay? What happened?
Well, he's fine. They're always fine. I just, I kind of beat him up and took it a little too far.
Whoa. You beat up your clone? Well, I'm sorry, buddy, but that's kind of creepy.
All right, well, look, you know how you spent all those years beating yourself up? Well, in 2050, that's all over, my friend. You just take it out on the clone. It's actually why most people have them anyway.
Wait. So in the future, I have a clone, and I just use him as a punching bag?
Well, that's not what he's for. You know, he cooks, he cleans, he does the things you don't want to do. He attends events for me sometimes. He stands in line for stuff. I make him buy condoms. Yeah, stuff like that.
But mostly you just hit him.
You don't understand, Mark. Crime has gone way down because of clones. They take the brunt of people's frustrations. There's hardly any more domestic abuse now that you can kick your clone's ass instead.
Look, I'm sorry, man, but that it just sounds exactly like domestic abuse to me.
No. It's not. They don't bleed or anything. They don't even feel physical pain. I even shot him once, and then I sent him out for pizza. The problem is, actually, you can hurt their feelings, all right? I mean, they are still you know.
Mr. Marin, your clone is ready to go home now.
Oh, hey, Mark, my clone's here. Hold on. You told me he fell down the stairs, right? Like we said, right? All right, now shut up. I'm on the phone.
Wow, this is really weird. I mean, I don't want to judge you, but man. Can I talk to the clone for a minute?
Okay. But I mean, don't go on and on, you know. You know how they get. Hey, buddy, what's up?
Hey, buddy, what's up? So, Future Mark clone. Look, I'm sorry you're in the hospital, buddy.
Oh, no. It's my fault. I don't know when to shut up. I deserve the beating. You're always right. I should learn. I mean, sometimes I mouth off and I get a beating. You're always sorry afterwards, so it's okay.
But don't you ever get sick of that? I mean, don't you have any rights?
Rights? What is this rights you speak of? Whoa. Hey, buddy. We don't use the R word around the clones, man. They're better off not knowing. Hey. Go sit in the car. I'll deal with you later.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Okay, man. I'm back.
Okay. So is everybody like this to their clones?
Hey, I'm one of the nice ones, okay? I mean, I'm not a clonist or anything. I've even been to Clone Town, like, a bunch of times. You know, it's like, as long as they know their place. You know what I'm saying? I mean, can you imagine if they could vote? Wow. That would be awful.
Oh, man. Dude, I usually enjoy these conversations, but today you're really making me kind of sad, kind of bummed, a little freaked out. But is there anything you want to tell me before I go?
Yeah, actually. Did you see the movie Signs?
You mean the one about the crop circles and the aliens?
Exactly. Okay, so here's what you need to do. You need to rent it again, and kind of get the message. And just for your own peace of mind, you might want to have a super soaker filled with water on you pretty much all the time. Now, hold on. Hey, Doc, this kidney just failed. What has it been in there, like 3 minutes? Well, get me another one. Sorry, man.
That's okay, man. But look, be nice to your clone.
Yeah, whatever. Later, man.
Later. It's always disturbing to talk to me in the future.
I can't wait to meet your clone.
Yeah, me too.
We're going to have to figure out the machinery to get him back here. Podcast Morning Sedition. You can do it every day. Go to morningsedition.com for details. Coming up next, Donald Trump's got a plan for Ground Zero. We got the iNews 5000. And do you know how old Malcolm X would be today if he were still alive? Air America Radio, 44 past the hour.
Morning Sedition. We can't do it without you. Call 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
How you doing, Mark? It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. If you're listening in New York, you're listening to LIB, WLIB 1190. Hey, it's Be Nice to Your IT Guy Day today. Many of them are tired. They've, you know, been up all night in costumes seeing the new Star Wars movie. And according to a new study sponsored by the Department of Homeland Security, that's found that the corporate insiders who sabotage computers and networks are motivated mainly by anger against their bosses. And this can mean any business. So be nice to your IT guy, all right, when you're flailing around in a panic because you don't know how to change your screensaver. You've just lost all your important documents. Yes, sir.
My brother's an IT guy, and I can tell you he's screwed my computer up like maybe a dozen times.
On purpose.
Yes, without question.
Oh, my God. See that?
Really?
See that? Give him a donut. To ask him how he's doing. Don't get in too deep. It could get a little weird. Anyways, before we get to the iNews 5000 here, it is Malcolm X's birthday. We're going to talk a little bit about that. Do you know how old he is? Also, Donald Trump's got some big plans. We're going to talk about that, you know, momentarily. But right now, sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily, we, of course, have the iNews 5000. It's a headline translator. Let's crank it up and feed it some headlines. That's soon to be available for a dial tone. From the New York Times, plan would broaden FBI's terror role. Plan would broaden FBI's terror role. Translation, CIA, Homeland Security promised to CC feds on terror alerts. From Fox News, Last Star Wars opens amidst much fanfare. Translation, millions of IT workers call in sick, cripple American economy. Be nice to them today. From Associated Press, workers find 193-year-old bottle of whiskey. Workers find 193-year-old whiskey bottle. Translation, American bricklayers get drunk on 1812 booze, burn Washington, invade Canada. Okay, there you go. A little history funny at the end there. Who's a history funny? How about a history serious now? Malcolm X would be how old today, Mark Riley?
80.
80 years old today.
He was born May 19th, 1925. He had the name Malcolm Little. That was how he was born. He was also known as Detroit Red. He later became Malcolm X and then El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz. He had a profound and lasting impact on the African-American community, not just here in New York, but all over the country, and in fact, all over the world.
You know, I just saw the Malcolm X film, the Spike Lee film on TV, and I locked in. I'd seen it before. And it isn't as big a movie as it should be.
No.
It did not have the range that it should. Spike seems to get a little hung up with dance numbers.
Well, I mean,
am I wrong?
That was his way back then. I don't think he does it quite as much now. But if you want to see someone discuss Malcolm X from a position of knowledge,
yeah,
you should get the documentary or get a chance to see the documentary A Great and Mighty Walk, which is a bio of the late Professor John Henry Clark, who was Malcolm X's good friend.
Okay.
Professor Clark, during the course of that film, talks about Malcolm X, talks about how he used to call Professor Clark swine eater because, of course, Malcolm X, when he joined the Nation, they were death on the pig. So,
yes,
you know, Professor Clark, who says in the film that he had an affinity for pork chops, used to constantly get ribbed by Malcolm X.
Okay, so it wasn't a hostile thing.
Oh, no, it wasn't a hostile thing. I mean, they were buddies, and
yeah,
he still called them swine eater.
You know, I learned a lot about the history. I have not read the autobiography of Malcolm X, and I also, in the film, as pretty as that film is, you know, his attention to detail, his attention to costume, his attention to certain parts of history, the inconsistency was, you know, Spike sort of got, you know, he got hung up on a lot of style, and I didn't feel the full momentum. I thought Denzel was great, but I didn't feel the full momentum of what Malcolm X meant in the world.
Well, during one part of his life, the early part of his life, style was a very important thing to Malcolm X because he was a hustler.
Mm-hmm.
He lived in Boston, then he came to New York, he worked on the railroads. And he became a hustler. That's how he ended up getting incarcerated and then later converting to Islam. So it was a very important part of his life. But ironically enough, after he became a Muslim, after he began to recruit, because that was his strength, was as a recruiter for the Nation of Islam. And under his leadership, as far as the recruitment arm was concerned, the numbers of members of the Nation swelled during the late 50s, early 60s.
There's a couple of scenes that, you know, in front of the hospital. Did you like the film?
I enjoyed it. I mean, I knew Malcolm X's widow, Betty Shabazz, very well.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that she was heavily involved in making sure that elements of the film were true to what she remembered mm-hmm. as Malcolm X's life and legacy. But there's an exhibit here in New York at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, and it actually opens today on his birthday. And this particular exhibit has letters that he wrote to his brother, you know, rare pictures that were part of a collection of things that almost got lost by the Shabazz family. They almost actually ended up auctioning it all off. But they donated it for 75 years to the Schomburg. So if people are in New York and you want to know more about this man who really, I mean, he transformed Muhammad Ali's life because he recruited Muhammad Ali. He was central in recruiting Muhammad Ali into the nation, and the lives of many other people, and even today, people in the black community revere the memory of this man 40 years after his passing.
Tremendous impact.
Yes.
So now let's talk about an impact in another way. If you live here in New York, you listen to 1190, you know, certainly Donald Trump is no stranger to the planet, but this guy is a, you know, a, like a raconteur, a self-promoting master, a questionably rich person, a real estate developer, and now, you know, it's hard to tell, Riley, whether he's doing this to self-promote or this is an earnest plan of his.
It's both. He doesn't do anything without self-promotion, but he wants to rebuild the twin towers of the World Trade Center. If you look at the model that he unveiled yesterday to much fanfare, it looks exactly like the World Trade Center. Now, you can argue with the aesthetics of the World Trade Center design, and a lot of people did at the time. For years, nobody would move in there except the state of New York. But he is saying that without rebuilding the Trade Center towers as they looked before, and this is his quote, the terrorists win.
It's an interesting idea, and I got to be honest with you. I miss seeing the Trade Center on the skyline. My judgment of them architecturally was it fell backseat to just saying, well, that's part of New York, and that's where they belong, and that's where they are. As annoying as I find Donald Trump, and perhaps as uncomfortable as I was with the size of the design of the Trade Towers, I don't know if it's a horrible idea.
Well, look, the rebuilding of Ground Zero has become an ongoing embarrassment to the city and state of New York, which is why Trump has the room to step in with this foolishness in the first place, and he's going to promote it on that god-awful, I shouldn't say god-awful, I've never seen it, but The Apprentice.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually going to push this design of his. He calls the original Freedom Tower design that was done by Daniel Liebskin and this other guy that was put together by the governor as an egghead design.
To aesthetic, and he likes the sort of modern simplicity.
Some people might say his hair is an egghead design. He's got four strands of hair.
They're certainly not going to say he's an egghead. I'll tell you that.
No.
He's a real estate thug.
Much more stuff coming up. Bob Herbert, op-ed columnist for the New York Times, joins us.
Yes, and we're going to have my dream diary. And that's next.
Ooh, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Six past the hour, it's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Hey.
You're listening in New York, you're listening to Air America on WLIB 1190. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, working class heroes, lurking conservatives, the self-righteous, the decent people of this country. Good morning to you people out west who are listening to us in the middle of the night and just getting home and taking off your lightsaber and your Darth Vader hats. Good morning to you who saw the midnight movie of Star Wars, or the 1 a.m. movie, or the 10 a.m., the 10 p.m. movie, the 11 p.m. movie. This thing is running every 10 minutes, a woman told us from Sacramento.
Yeah.
The word is out. People are into it. I wish I knew what was going on. I've got to go back and catch up. I don't know what the hell is going on. I do know that some Republican critics are accusing it of being partisan politics. Thank God. Thank God art is reflecting life a little bit. Thank God Lucas, who said he conceived of this film, Mark Riley, during the Vietnam War, was not ashamed to say that the similarities are mind-blowing and that if it's in there, so be it. Thank God he's got that 70s sensibility when auteurs in American cinema took chances, took opportunities to do cultural critiques, political critiques. If you want a podcast, Morning Sedition, you can go to morningsedition.com for details on that. This story jumps right out at me all day long, Riley. I read this last night and it's killing me. This dude, Tubin, this guy was charged with conspiring to jam Democrats get out the vote phones on Election Day in 2002. James Tubin, on trial up in Maine, wants to get Democrats off his jury.
That's insane. I mean, it's insane, but his lawyers are actually trying to make that move. So, you know, a judge is going to have to rule on this. But, you know, to set this kind of precedent, I think, would send shockwaves through the entire legal community. What this guy is saying is that because Democrats were the targets of his alleged acts, they should not sit in judgment of him.
It's a dangerous precedent to set because civic duty is civic duty. Democracy is, you know, all-encompassing. It's a political system designed to have checks and balances and to be representative of both parties and of people that may not even do anything. Independents, libertarians, people who don't vote, Democrats, Republicans. As an American, you should be afforded the opportunity to judge a peer in a fair, just way. It has nothing to do with partisan politics. If this precedent is set, it's really bad news. These guys are civil warriors, you know, in terms of the Civil War. Political hacks, political hoods, political thugs on the Republican side want nothing more than to continue to divide this country. They're anti-American.
Well, what this guy is alleged to have done is to jam phone lines that were used to get out the vote for Democrats during last year's election, and also jamming apparently a phone line that was used to get people, shuttle people to the polls. Apparently the Firefighters Union in Manchester, New Hampshire, had a get-out-the-vote motorcade kind of thing going on where they would shuttle people to the polls if they had no other way to get there. He allegedly jammed that.
Hmm.
So he was trying to do, in some small way, what Catherine Harris managed to do in Florida back in 2000, which is preclude Democrats from getting to the polls.
I think I hope that the jury is balanced, and I hope that they'll see that, you know, by and large, Democrats aren't as dirty and aren't as horrendously insidious and evil in their intent and you know, broken in terms of, you know, they break the laws, these guys, and I think that he should go down. And I don't think that they should mix that jury up. I don't think that they should break that jury up. They can't do that because it would be a slippery slope, wouldn't it, Riley?
It would be an extraordinarily slippery slope. And this guy even is going further. He wants them to throw out his indictment based on the fact there were Democrats that were part of the grand jury.
Well, last week, look at this. This week, Los Angeles elected its first Latino mayor in 133 years, and New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg unveiled his first reelection campaign ads, which are in Spanish.
Yes.
Appealing to Latino voters is more important than ever, and the Democratic Party has been hard at work trying to find ways to lure this vital demographic. But we're a little worried about their strategy because we here at Morning Sedition obtained a rough draft of some of the slogans they're considering, and I'm not sure this is the right approach, Riley. Let's look at some of these. How about this one? Thank you for taking the jobs no one else wants.
Oh, Lord.
Not bad. How about, your votes are important. Why not think of Election Day as Martes Gigante?
Oh, God.
How about this? How about your children are beautiful. Are they all yours?
Ooh.
Oh, wait. I'm just reading it.
And this is the Democrats?
No, this is this is from the Bloomberg campaign.
Because it will win Brandon Influence people.
How about this? Here's one. How about that Sammy Sosa? Vote for me. Anyone? All right. Okay.
You running for mayor of Baltimore?
A lot of people don't think graffiti is art. I do. Vote for me.
No,
all right. I will push for a raise in the minimum wage for those of you on the books.
Oh yeah, right.
Okay. Now, Lou Dobbs wrote with that one. Come be in our gang.
Oh,
come on. I'm going to do the Dream Dire in a second. This is a real thing here. This is an amazing thing. This is, as we were talking about, during before the show today, Riley, that the Asian community, the Latino community, the face of ethnic New York and ethnic America has changed since the first wave of immigrants, which was primarily Italian, Jewish, Irish.
Yeah, in New York. And one of the things you're starting to see, Mark, is that things that have happened, for example, the Cuban migration to South Florida has created a very strong voting bloc of Cubans there. The migration of Vietnamese in the wake of the end of the war have created Vietnamese populations in cities all across the South and out into the West. Now, we're just at a point now where the sons and daughters of those original Vietnamese immigrants are coming of age.
Mm-hmm.
These are many of them born in the States. These are people who are going to start running for political office. These are people who are going to start running for city councils and school boards and that sort of thing. And you're going to see them have an impact. The Asian community, which is swelling here in New York, it's up to 500,000 people according to the 2000 census. And they are going to be a force. Just like the Latino community, 20, 30 years ago, you figured, well, you got one Puerto Rican politician, you could go to that one person, that's the person you dealt with. Can't do it like that anymore.
And this is also Morning's Edition's self-appointed Be Nice to Your IT Guy Day, because apparently a study sponsored by the Homeland Security Department found that corporate insiders who sabotage computers and networks are motivated mainly by anger against their bosses, and that could go for anybody. So, you know, that guy fixing your computer, remember, he holds the key to the universe, and he's been up late because he was at the Star Wars opening at midnight or 1 or 2. Right now, we do this on our show a few days a week. I've been instructed by my therapist to write down my dreams. Here's my dream from last night. I'm at home listening to Iggy on my iPod when the phone rings. I take the bud out of my left ear and answer the phone. The caller says, "Hello, can I speak to Mr. Mayron, please?" Damn telemarketer. The iPod says, "Mark, don't hang up. I'm sure she'll tell you about a product that will change your life." I say, "Ah, come on, man, do I have to?" The iPod says, "Mark, don't make me hurt you. I don't want to hurt you, but sometimes you make me hurt you. Say hello." I say, "Yes, this is Mr. Mayron." She says, "Have you heard about Invigranox? Prepare yourself for the most dramatic life-enhancing supplement available." I say, "Yeah, I can't wait to hear about it." The iPod says, "Mark, sarcasm never helps." She says, "Invigranox is an exciting new supplement that will supercharge your active lifestyle." I say, "So it's speed, right? Uppers, bennies." She says, "Mr. Mayron, a new study shows Invigranox increased bioglobulinogenies by as much as 60%, maybe more." I say, "It's crystal meth then, right? Herbal ecstasy?" iPod says, "Mark, I'm warning you. Don't make me hurt you." She says, "Formulated and used by expert medical doctors, Invigranox combines the latest scientific research with all important focus on natural health principles." It's crank, isn't it? Special K. "Mr. Mayron, this breakthrough system is a proprietary blend of safe and natural ingredients combined in the specific synergistic ratios." I say, "So do I snort it or do I need a spike for this?" The iPod says, "No, just your credit card. Mark, you're going to buy a year's supply of Invigranox. Tune out." I say, "But she won't tell me what it is. What the hell is this thing I'm buying?" Long story short, I buy it, I take it, I grow thick orange hair all over my body. The FDA bans Invigranox. I sue the company, win a huge settlement, and retire. I woke up and my bed was filled with metabolizers.
Woo!
Yes, next up, we got Bob Herbert. So stay with us. It's 15 past the hour here on America, Air America Radio.
Join the Morning Sedition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
After exposing the shadow government, Mark Maron, private investigator, returns next week to investigate and expose the most dangerous, dark, and powerful organization in American history. Its tentacles reach everywhere. Its evil message infects everyone, even reaching the highest seats of government. Can one slightly used private eye be a match for the religious right?
Mark, kneel with us now and pray. I said kneel and pray.
Now!
No! No! No!
Who is the real power behind the evil? That is the religious right.
My brothers and sisters, follow me. Follow him. Follow us. For you are the sheep he has chosen. You are his army of sheep.
You. How? It can't be. No!
He has the mark of the beast.
I think that's just a mole.
Destroy him.
On May 26th. Mark Maron starts a case that will take him to hell and back again.
I'll see you in hell. Hold on a minute. That didn't come out right. I'll see you in heaven? Nah, that doesn't really work.
Don't miss an episode of Mark Maron and the Temple of Doom.
21 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio here in New York. You're listening to 1190 WLIB. If you want a podcast out there in the world, if you can't get us in the time zone that you like, you can podcast. You can go to morningsedition.com for details on that. We've got Bob Herbert coming up. If you don't know who Bob Herbert is, he's an op-ed writer for the New York Times. He's a modern-day muckraker in the spirit of such legendary expositors as Murray Kempton, I. F. Stone, Jack Newfield. His columns have been called the conscience of the New York Times op-ed page, and he's got a book coming out. And we did a story here. We talked about a story. We interviewed a guy that he featured.
Yeah,
in
Aiden
one
Delgado.
Of his stories. Aiden
yeah.
Delgado. Now, before we get into Delgado, I just want to say that a poll just came out, a Harris poll just came out, that says that more people now than ever think that George W. Bush botched the Iraq War. Am I reading this right, Riley? 48%.
Yeah, 48%. And his, his negative ratings in terms of his handling of the war, are apparently virtual all time high.
And you know whose fault that is, don't you, Riley? George Lucas in the Star Wars movie.
Oh, was that who?
Sure, clearly this is the fault of the new Star Wars film that his approval ratings went down because it's so political, you know. And Newsweek, of course, was responsible for World War II, for Jesus' crucifixion, and apparently new Muslim unrest over there in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and Pakistan.
You know, it's fascinating because it seemed as though Bush was going to ride a wave of positive news out of Iraq right after the elections, which were at the end of January. You see how fast this has turned, Mark?
Well, and I couldn't be more thrilled about it. And now even as generals, I mean, this report here that a series of interviews and briefings have revealed that there's a lot of mixed messages out there. And now this administration likes mixed messages.
Yeah.
It protects them from ever revealing the truth, and it enables them to blame as many people as possible and not take responsibility for anything.
Well, I mean, at this point, that kind of confusion allows the administration to continue to pursue what is obviously a wrong-headed policy in Iraq. I mean, Bob Herbert has written some extremely trenchant columns for the New York Times, just flat out saying that the Bush administration lied its way into war and has cost the lives of 1,600 American soldiers in the process.
Yeah, and that's one of these unnamed high-level officials. Some of them are saying it could still fail because, you know, the nature of the insurgency, the tactics of the insurgency, the inabilities and trouble they're having in creating an Iraqi police force, an Iraqi national security system with Iraqis who are afraid. They can't get Iraqis to do their military briefings out of fear. I am not hoping that this happens, but in light of the lies this administration has told us, it's important that this truth gets out. Like Aiden Delgado. This is a story that Bob Herbert wrote about Aiden Delgado, who we interviewed on our show.
Yes.
He was an Army reservist who witnessed abuses by the military in Abu Ghraib and other areas in Iraq. He was profiled by Bob Herbert in a May 2nd edition of the New York Times. He was on Morning Sedition 2 weeks ago. This is what he had to say.
Guys in my unit used to drive by in their Humvee and break bottles over Iraqis' heads. It has provoked an enormous, enormous outpouring of hatred and venom against me, against Bob Herbert. And to even say that has provoked an enormous, enormous outpouring of hatred and venom against me.
For what?
The fact is,
for telling the truth?
But, I mean, people would flatly deny that what I saw happened, rather than believe these sorts of things happen. But the fact is, I mean, a master sergeant whipped a group of Iraqi children with a steel Humvee antenna in Nasiriyah because they were crowding around him, bothering him for food and water. And, you know, I wish this wasn't true. I wish I didn't have to report this, but it happened.
So I am excited to meet Bob Herbert because he's definitely a guy who stands up for what the truth is and has the courage to take the other side and take it all the way. There's only a couple of guys that do that these days.
Well, yeah, and Bob is a muckraker. Mm-hmm. He's a guy who is not afraid to step into situations where there can be some political feathers ruffled, but he'll speak the truth no matter what. And his coverage of Aiden Delgado, of which, again, you know, Aiden Delgado got plenty of flack about it. We'll find out in a little bit whether Bob Herbert got a lot of flack about it.
It's interesting, you know, what's going on, you know, in the military. You know, you have stories like that. You have stories from these generals that that Iraq war might fail. It's a lot more difficult than it seems. It's not going to be clear whether or not we get out of there anytime soon. They're closing military bases in Connecticut, Maine, Alaska, South Dakota, New Jersey, Missouri, Kentucky, New Mexico, Illinois. It's very hard to make sense of all this stuff, but I'll tell you one thing. When we talk to Bob Herbert, he's got a clear understanding of what is right and wrong and what the truth is and what the truth isn't on the journalistic level. Have you met him before?
I just did New York One with him about 3 weeks ago.
Oh, so you know him. The book is Promises Betrayed, Waking Up from the American Dream. Bob Herbert will be up next.
Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. If you're listening in New York, you're listening to 1190 WLIB. New York Times op-ed columnist Bob Herbert will join us momentarily to talk about his new book, Promises Betrayed, Waking Up from the American Dream, a collection of op-ed pieces. But, you know, there are lots of big stories in the news this week, so it's time to get some bets down with our own Inside the Beltway odds maker, Johnny Castree. Johnny Castree, where's the action, brother?
It follows me, baby.
All right.
All right, here we go. I got Koran action for you.
Uh-huh.
Even Allah would put money on this.
Oh, man.
$5,001. You don't hear George W. Bush say the word Koran in public the rest of the week.
Right.
If he does, I'll not only pay off, I'll play craps at the Taj Mahal wearing a burqa,
all
right, baby.
I'll take that for $500, Johnny.
I got a C-No right here.
Funny story, if I may.
Uh-huh.
Last night, my brother-in-law, Johnny E. Street, bets a guy at the bar, 10 large, you can flush a Koran down a toilet. The guy says, get a Koran and put your money up.
Oh,
2 hours later, he's handing over 10 large and cursing Johnny in every language but Farsi. He flushed it one page at a time.
Oh,
he looks at me and says, who's in a rush, baby?
Oh, boy. Speaking of the Koran, you're going to get us in trouble here, Johnny. Speaking of the Koran, what's the word on Newsweek, brother?
All right, this is a solid bet, believe me. 5-1, if the White House tries to edit one more magazine, Larry Flint threatens to publish pictures of John Bolton in a Speedo at Plato's Retreat doing a bump off Warren Hutton's ass. Circa 1975.
All right, I'm down for a G on that, my friend.
Come to think of it, I might have been at Plato's Retreat that night. Put me down for 5 large, Johnny.
You're down.
So you remember it then? What's the line on the 7th filibuster?
Before I give you the lowdown, I want you to mark today on your calendar as so you can look back on it and say, that's a day Johnny K. made me rich.
All right.
You ready?
Yeah.
Even money, Bush gets all his nominees, but they find out Priscilla Owen used to work as a madam in Vegas for 2 years and has a black book with every Halliburton executive sexual preference in it. She leaves the bench in disgrace.
Put me down for $1,000, bro.
I'm down for $1,000, and I never wanted anything to be true more than this.
Side bet, Dick Cheney in diapers, 2-1. And that's it. One more thing before I go, Mark.
Yeah.
I don't like to say this on the air, but you're into me for about 30 large in the biggest running. Just a reminder.
Come on, buddy. Come
maybe
on,
book
buddy.
A few extra stand-up gigs. That's all I'm saying,
I,
you know.
I, oh,
while
man.
You can stand. Word to the wise. You're doing good work here. I've got to get to court.
Oh, man.
See you later.
See you later.
Later on, Johnny.
Now I'm scared.
Yeah,
now
really.
I'm 30. I didn't have no idea.
30 large, man?
All right, so let's talk a little bit about Bob Herbert. He's going to be in here in just a second. The op-ed columnist of the New York Times, who broke the story of a guest we had 2 weeks ago, Aiden Delgado, an Army reservist who witnessed abuses in the military in Abu Ghraib and in a lot of different places in Iraq. He was profiled by Bob Herbert, and we talked to him. You know, apparently, how long have you been reading Bob Herbert? I mean, it's been years, right?
Well, actually, since before he got to the Times.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, let's hear this sound from Aiden Delgado, and we'll talk to Bob in just a second.
Guys in my unit used to drive by in their Humvee and break bottles over Iraqis' heads. Has provoked an enormous, enormous outpouring of hatred and venom against me, against Bob Herbert. And to even say that has provoked an enormous, enormous outpouring of hatred and venom against me.
For what?
The fact is,
for telling the truth?
But I mean, people would flatly deny that what I saw happened, rather than believe these sorts of things happen. But the fact is, I mean, a master sergeant whipped a group of Iraqi children with a steel Humvee antenna in Nasiriyah because they were crowding around him, bothering him for food and water. And, you know, I wish this wasn't true. I wish I didn't have to report this, but it happened.
Profound stuff. He has been described as a conscience of a great newspaper, and it's true he gives voice to those otherwise ignored in today's media. Bob Herbert is an op-ed columnist with the New York Times and author of the newly released Promises Betrayed, Waking Up from the American Dream. Bob Herbert, welcome to Morning Sedition.
Great to see you guys. Good morning, Bob.
It's great to meet you. Now, what are primarily the promises betrayed that you describe in your book?
Well, I think of it a couple of things. One is the promise of fairness, which everybody anticipates when they're getting started in the United States, and then there's the promise of expanding opportunity, and I think those are sort of the two cornerstones of the American dream. And what I've been telling people is that you don't hear people talking about the American dream as much as maybe when I was growing up in the 1950s and 60s,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's in large part because the promise is not as strong as it once was. It's much more difficult now for people starting out without a lot of money and without social advantages to build the kind of life that people were able to build in the 50s and 60s. It's more difficult now to break into the middle class.
Starting out in debt, some people get out of college strapped with like $40,000 in debt. People come to this country and they're shut out by obviously by Republican policies. And now it seems that the people have gotten this administration. Republican ideas have made people more selfish, less aware of community, less aware of people struggling.
See, I think that's an important point, and it's not just the people starting out. If you look at the middle class in this country, so many families are mortgaged up to their eyeballs. So many people have maxed out on their credit cards.
Mm-hmm.
So they're maintaining their middle class status by borrowing,
mm-hmm.
constant borrowing, and, no end in sight.
Yeah. Bob, the other day, and you don't know this, but I was riding a bus down 9th Avenue here in New York, and I saw you and your two colleagues, Sam Roberts and Clyde Haberman, walking up 9th Avenue. Clyde had his Borsellino on. And I'm thinking to myself, these are three really great journalists that came up in this town.
Three really old journalists.
But are you and the kind of work that you do an endangered species? And the reason why I ask that is one of the central premises of your book, Promise is Betrayed, Waking Up from the American Dream, is that public ignorance is hurting American society. And I'm wondering, are people who read broadsheet newspapers, dwindling away as we're being told they
are? Oh, they're definitely dwindling. I mean, it's a struggle even for big newspapers like the New York Times or a paper that I came from years ago, the Daily News. You always have to figure out a way not just to survive, but to try and turn a profit. It's a business after all. But if you get away from the Times, which I think has maintained its commitment to great journalism, you'll find an increasing commodification of the news, and it becomes more and more about the bottom line rather than doing the primary job of informing the public. And the danger there is that you have an electorate that goes to the polls and votes, but is not properly informed about the issues that they're voting on.
We're talking to New York Times columnist Bob Herbert. His book, Promises Betrayed, Waking Up from the American Dream. You just addressed before the ownership society, which is what I call the culture of debt, and, mm-hmm. and you agree with me on that. What I want to know is I want to have some hope, Bob, and I think that what you're doing is a great service to humanity in terms of addressing some of the issues that the unrepresented are not able to address themselves. Is this? Do we have hope? Has this happened in America before? Is there a light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah, I think there's hope. I don't know about whether I can see the light at the end of the tunnel. It might be a long tunnel. But sure, there's hope. And I'll tell you the main reason why I think there's hope. I think that we've come through situations that have been so much worse than this situation is now. The United States survived the Depression. We survived World War II. You know, terrible things happen, and there's something about human beings that their resilience ultimately triumphs. But it can take a long time, and there can be a lot of suffering along the way. And I think we're going through that period of suffering, and we haven't yet figured out how to turn this thing around.
But ultimately, as you were saying before, even with, you know, people not reading newspapers as much, and being that there is a tremendous buffet of information and misinformation, truth and untruths out there, that eventually when it comes right home to them, when they're economically strapped, or they're feeling the pressure in their own life, or they start to see what the hell is going on out there, and historically, they tend to wake up and vote appropriately.
That's exactly right, and that's what I think ultimately will happen here. And I think that you can see that the Republicans have, there's some speed bumps along the way as far as the Republicans are concerned. I mean, you know, Tom DeLay has become an embarrassment. I think the economy is, at best, just sort of limping along. Bush was not able to win his Social Security fight. That was a political downside. The war in Iraq is not going well, and more Americans are becoming fed up with that war. So it's not like, the Republicans are just cruising along. If the Democrats are wise enough, now we don't know whether that's true or not, but if the Democrats are wise enough, there's some openings that they could take advantage of.
Mm. Bob, what do you make of this whole Newsweek brouhaha? You went through the same thing at the Times with Jason Blair. How do you think this thing is going to play out?
Well, there's some critical differences with the Jason Blair thing. Jason Blair was making stuff up. I mean, there's just no defense there at all. As I read this Newsweek situation, everybody is vulnerable who does real journalism, because to some degree you have to rely on unnamed sources. You try and do that as little as possible. I try not to do it, but sometimes you don't have any choice. And even a good source can make an honest mistake. And if you have an unnamed source and that source makes a mistake, you're just in trouble. In this case, the great tragedy, of course, is that there were deaths in connection with this entire situation. But I think that, the cynical way in which the administration is trying to exploit this is regrettable. And, Newsweek has retracted the story. It was a mistake. But you can't blame, I don't think you can blame Newsweek for the entirety of the riots that took these lives. I mean, there's a great deal of anti-American feeling out there, and the basis for those feelings is something that we need to address as a nation.
What I want to know, Bob Herbert, is if we could talk about it in a second, after we take a break here, is whose fault is it? You know, a lot of working people are voting against their economic self-interest for reasons that, Thomas Frank speculates it's because of moral issues. Other people have made other speculations. I want to hear your take on this, and ultimately, what is the responsibility of these individuals, as part of this democracy, if it's going to function? If we can address that in just a second, coming up next, we're talking to Bob Herbert, columnist for the New York Times. A new book is Promises Betrayed, Waking Up from the American Dream.
Call us at 866.
Ha! That's awesome. Go on.
303.
Wow. Yes. Yes. I love it.
2270.
Oh, yeah. Drop the bomb. Drop it. There's not a dry eye in the house. Keep going.
That's 866-303-2270.
Okay. Well, just so you know, it was good, but I was also being pretty generous.
This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Hey, 7:50 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program here in New York. You're listening to WLIB 1190. We're talking to a New York Times columnist, Bob Herbert, about his book, Promises Betrayed, Waking Up from the American Dream. The question I posed before the little break there was essentially, why do people vote against their economic self-interest, and ultimately, whose responsibility and how are they going to wake up?
Well, I think there's a variety of reasons, and one of the important reasons is the issues are becoming more and more complex, and many voters don't understand the issues. But the responsibility, while it's always ultimately with the voters in a democracy, I am just a big believer in leadership. I mean, strong leaders can take you in any direction. So you can have people following Lyndon Johnson in the mid-60s to the left and following Ronald Reagan in the 1980s to the right. And the obligation now to fight on behalf of working people in the middle class falls to the Democratic Party, which is the party of opposition. And I don't think that that party has done a good job. I think that it's had trouble defining itself. I think it's had trouble making the presenting its side of the issues in a compelling way to the voters. And then maybe even worst of all, it's a party that has decided that because we had some electoral setbacks, that the answer is to drift closer and closer to the positions of our opponents. And that says to me that you don't really stand for anything, that your values are decided by which way the wind is blowing.
Bob Herbert, it's, I think, apt that you're here on Malcolm X's birthday. He would have been 80 years old.
Oh, man, I can't. That's hard to believe, right?
Yeah, really. What do you see in terms of this, quote, rise in black conservatism? We see black preachers who are making common cause with George W. Bush. We see a 7-point spike in the black vote for George Bush in Ohio this past Election Day. Is this just a blip on the radar screen, or is this part of a trend that may be a permanent cornerstone of black America?
I don't think it's a permanent cornerstone, but I do think it reflects the failure of leadership that I was talking about, because while I was complaining about the Democrats, I don't think the failure of the leadership is limited to the Democrats. I don't think there's decent leadership in the Republican Party, even though they've been winning some elections. And I don't think that there is great black leadership now. I mean, you're talking about Malcolm X's birthday. There was a time when we had Malcolm X's, when you had Martin Luther King's, when you had James Farmer. Mm-hmm. There was a time when even before black people were able to go to college in the numbers that they're going now, there was black leadership that kept the population informed on the important issues of the day. And I see a dearth of leadership now, and I think it's tragic. And perhaps the most tragic part of it are those legions of young people, teenagers and young adults, especially in the big cities, who are out there, out of school, out of work, and in many cases just about out of hope. That's a great tragedy.
Well, we were talking a bit about how, you know, the ethnic profile of, let's use New York as an example, this is a city we all live in, as being completely different than it was with the first wave of immigrants. And now these people who are coming to America, and some of them are, you know, second and third generations in this country, you know, how does it become appealing? The Democratic message, you would think, would be very appealing to this community. And, you know, and certainly Bloomberg is trying to appeal to this community. I mean, how are the Republicans duping them?
Well, I'm not sure when you talk in terms of immigrants that they're duped. I think that they bring a different perspective to politics than Americans who are, you know, longer than second or third generation. But it's also kind of important to remember how diverse the immigrant community is.
Yes.
Now, you used to be able to define the immigrants, pretty clearly. And you could define their interests pretty clearly. That's no longer the case. And the funny thing is, you know, it may be the fact that it's a product of success. I mean, even though there's a lot of bleakness in my book, over the past 40 or 50 years, there's been some tremendous triumphs in the United States. So when you expand opportunity like we have over that period, it promotes diversity. So you have different people with different interests.
Bob, what should be built at Ground Zero?
You know, I was never a big fan of building another tall tower down at Ground Zero. But, you know, even though it's not my decision to make. I mean, I would have liked to have seen a beautiful new neighborhood grow up at Ground Zero. You know,
low rise neighborhood
plus a memorial. But what I would like to say is, no matter what you're going to build there, this, once again, failure of leadership. You have not had the top officials in New York, both at the state and at the city level, just on top of that and saying, you know, this is the biggest development issue in New York. It follows on a great tragedy. There's a big emotional stake for New Yorkers here. Let's make sure that we get this job done and get it right. And instead, they're behaving as though they don't know what they're doing.
It's embarrassing.
But wasn't there also, they felt like they had to respect the people that were lost. They had to respect the interests of the people that lost people. They had to respect the interests of the city. And it seemed to get confusing, and it was very hard to
Which is why you needed the
good leadership.
Why you needed the top people to stay on top of it all along to make sure it kept going forward, because it's a tough job.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Bob Herbert, for being with us.
Really appreciate it, Bob.
It was great talking to you. The book is Promises Betrayed, walking up from the American Dream. Come on, take a walk up the American Dream. Waking up from the American Dream. You can read his column in the New York Times. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Coming up next, very exciting. Tim Robbins will be in the studio discussing the film version of his play Embedded, which is going to come out on DVD May 31st. He's going to hang out for a while.
While we talk about Mickey and Goofy.
Well, maybe he'll hang out that long, but we do got a guy that went undercover at Disney World to reveal a teeming world of sex, booze, and drinking. Yeah, that's right.
Really?
Yeah, sometimes Winnie the Pooh's a little high. I'm not making this up.
And we do know that, you're not making up, fat boy.
And we do know that Tigger has had his problems in the past.
Oh, yeah. A little bit of this. Hey, you know, I'm going there next month, you know.
Well, maybe you can get some pointers where you should go.
The
secret place is just around the corner from Disneyland. So Tim Robbins is coming up again. Great talking to you, Bob Herbert. You have a good day. And so, as I said before, coming up next, Tim Robbins here on Air America Radio.
Call us at 866-303-2270. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Six past the hour. It's Air America's Morning Edition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yes, it is.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Good morning, you lurking conservatives. Hey, it looks like the sheeple are starting to wake up, folks. Bush's rating on the Iraq war negatively up to 48%. People are starting to say,
highest level ever.
Yeah, it's good news. It's good news also in a promotional sense. For our guests, very excited to have Tim Robbins in the studio. His play Embedded will be released on DVD on May 31st. You can go to embeddedlive.com for all the info. He's also in Steven Spielberg's new movie, War of the Worlds, Academy Award winner. Did I already say that? Do I need to say more? Good morning, sir. How are you?
How you
good
doing?
Morning. Nice to be here. Nice to see you. Let's do this thing. Maybe you'll find this funny. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we've already talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. All right. A telephone company promotes anti-gay agenda. With their long-distance service, when you try to call the West Village, San Francisco, or South Beach, you get a message that says, "We're sorry, the person you were trying to call is gay. Please call back. Please call back when you re-examine your priorities." Their number is easy to remember. It's 1-800-HATE-FAGS.
Oh, Jesus.
All right, school teachers in India are told to cover up with aprons so students don't get distracted. In India, many women teachers wear saris. The school principal said it was tired of male students staring at their teachers' sorry asses. All right. A 2-year study showed that adolescent boys were losing concentration placement in classes with female teachers. Of course, that's an outrage that it took 2 years to conclude high school boys will ogle at a hot teacher. All right. Ellen DeGeneres. This one's demonic and exciting. Ellen DeGeneres says she was molested as a teen. Right now, a bunch of people in the Bible Belt are thinking, but that's supposed to cure lesbianism, right? That's a deep joke.
Ouch.
That is a deep joke. I think it's deep. All right, that's your morning tradition, Cliff Notes.
So deep, why did you crunch up the paper?
Because you know what I do. I crunch it up. And did it go in?
No.
No.
All right.
You're getting close, though.
So, Tim, you know, we were just talking earlier about how they're accusing Star Wars, George Lucas, they're saying the movie is liberal propaganda, that because of something that was said in the film, it was obviously, taking a shot at Bush.
Well, when you play Chewbacca's lines backwards.
There you go.
Yeah, Bush is the Antichrist. Yeah. But, you know, certainly, and then some people, a guy used to be Columbia, someone speaking on behalf of the film industry, said if you're going to put movies out there that are political, you should be aware of what you're putting out there. He wasn't saying it as a self-censoring thing, but thank God George Lucas actually stood up and just said, look, I saw this during the Vietnam War. The parallels are unbelievable.
The bottom line is that I think the reason why there's been such a strong intimidation of artists and actors and about speaking out against policies of this particularly this administration, mm-hmm. It's not because we're naive. It's not because we don't have anything to offer the equation. It's because whether you like it or not, those kinds of people have influence in society. And the point to ostracizing us is to keep others from speaking out as well.
But I also think, from where I'm standing, and obviously from where you're standing creatively, because of Embedded, and it's a brilliant play, and the DVD looks great, the production values are sweet, and I like the behind the stage stuff and all that stuff, seeing you guys changing the costume, is that art and creativity, as a creative person, like even the films of the 70s, they should be political. They should reflect the conflicts that are going on in culture.
Well, certainly now. I mean,
yeah.
There's so much material. There's, 1,000 stories a day coming out of Iraq. That,
mm-hmm.
What we were doing with Embedded was an immediate reaction to what was going on. Our first show was in July 2003, so it was 2 months after he landed on the aircraft carrier. And I believe, unfortunately, it's still as vital and as raw and uncompromising a piece as it was then. The point, though, was that we were reacting immediately because we had a theater.
Mm-hmm.
To do with
mm-hmm.
it. And a reason I filmed this was because it was coming to the end of his run in New York, and I saw that it was still as vital and still as exciting, and I knew that it would, unfortunately, continue to be. The problem with Vietnam, for example, is it took about 6 or 7 years after the war before the first real good movie about it came out.
But during the 70s, a lot of the movies were dealing with the cultural strife that it was causing.
That's
and
that, true.
And the generational shift and the sort of existential despair of a generation and the shifting of generations and different attitudes about the war.
I believe that's going to happen again.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I think that there's going to be a new a renaissance in movie making. It's just going to, don't expect it from the regular sources. The great news is that there's alternative delivery systems now. Embedded is not going to be coming to your local Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
But it is through Netflix. It's going to be available to those subscribers first and through my internet site at embeddedlive.com. That's the exciting news about now is that you can make a movie for a lot less money and deliver it to a lot more people.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of getting people out of the paradigm of that you must go to the Cineplex in order to experience culture.
Mm-hmm.
That gives me hope that maybe one day we'll see like another Z or some of these films that I came up watching.
Oh man, the 70s was an unbelievable.
It was an unbelievable time. I mean, I was profoundly moved by the Battle of Algiers, for God's sake.
Me too.
Extraordinary
me too.
Film. I was a big fan of Truffaut and this sort of thing, but I really don't go to movies anymore, largely because they end up being so disappointing, both artistically. And political.
It's interesting because some of the people that are being pushed as the new auteurs, you go and there's a lot of great style, but very little substance. And I was talking to, I went to Gang of Four last night, mm-hmm. at the Irving Plaza, this punk band.
How are they holding up?
They're Absolutely.
Yeah.
I almost went to the F word.
Yeah, you
but,
did.
Really, really good.
Yeah,
really
great.
Good. Even better than they were.
Well, don't you use and the Clash in the
yes.
on your embedded DVD?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And we were talking after the show, and I was talking to them about it. They were talking about how they listen to the quote unquote punk bands now. And it's all form and no substance for them.
Posturing.
Well, yeah. There's no lyrics. There's
yeah.
no political stance.
Right.
There's nothing behind the rage. And we kind of both agreed that yes, that's coming. It's coming, but it has to be informed with more rage.
Look at the tone of comedies today. I mean, you know, this whole Vaughn, Stiller, Owen Wilson, Matrix are, you know, they're goofball comedies. It's a new age of slapstick. The socially relevant comedies have yet to happen.
Yes, but I do believe they're right around the corner. I just think, don't expect them at your Cineplex.
Okay.
Is it generational? I mean, do we have to wait for a bunch of kids who are sitting up in the high school that's right next door to us here to get bored and then go out and make their own kinds of things?
I think that there's people my age that are pissed off and that are ready to go. It's just a matter of get breaking out of the mold of you know. It's a lot of times in Hollywood, you go out and you realize people want to be legitimized by a big deal in order to do what they want to do. They need to have the money up front. They need to have a certain sexy contract. And what you have to realize is you got something to say, say it. You know, now's the time to do it. There's no time to wait for it to be legitimized by a studio picture contract.
And also, yeah, I think what is missing from big pictures, and I think that will become available through the avenues that you're talking about, is just the human element. Is if you look at Hal Ashby's movies, you look at Being There, or you look at The Last Detail, and you look at some of the movies that came out in the 70s, they had the patience to deal with the way characters really unfold. Even
yes.
in Dead Man Walking.
Yes.
I mean, even there, you know, you saw, and obviously you know, that you evolved this guy as a person, which is why it was so compelling.
Yes, and there's a lot of great European films that are mm-hmm. still carrying that tradition on. It's just, you know, when I take my kids to those, do we have to read?
Why is there reading? I want to talk to you about this coming up. Jane Fonda and your significant other are on lists.
Yeah.
Let's
nice.
Coming up next with Tim Robbins here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, fighting treason with reason. This is Air America Radio. You're listening to Morning Sedition. Call us at 866-303-2270. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Air America Radio's Morning Edition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yo.
We're sitting here with Tim Robbins, whose play Embedded is now available on DVD at Embedded. Now it's not in front of me, Tim.
EmbeddedLive.com.
There you go.
It's not really a play. It's more like a rock and roll show.
I'm sorry. It's a rock and roll play.
rock and roll play show, man.
Wow.
Well, you say the word play and people go,
play.
Really?
Yeah. Man, we don't have quite
Mom.
A problem, though. That thing drives me nuts.
But it's logical because, you know what, a lot of plays really are boring, and you sit there and you go, I'm stuck here, and this is, you know, for 2 hours, and my mom took me, and I feel...
But that show kicks out. I mean, I watched it on DVD, and it starts out, you know, really intense with the sort of the pairings, you know,
yes.
of the people who are having people and their families leave for the war, and then bam, it just turns into this whole different thing.
Yeah, it's loud, it's raucous, rambunctious. The Actors Gang's been, we started as a kind of our version of theater, you know, all being punk rockers and wanting to do theater that was vital and exciting about something. And we're still together 23 years later, and this one really kicks it out.
Now, you're promoting this in a different... You have a partnership with Netflix, which I'm sure many people in our audience are aware of, but they're doing some interesting things in terms of trying to, you know, help find an audience for this as well. Talk about that.
Well, what they're doing is they're providing a delivery system that does not have to have legitimization from any of the major conglomerates.
Amen.
And so they're promoting it through their website, They have 3 million subscribers. They're very smart about the way they do business in that if you rented a particular film, they would suggest films like that. So
yeah.
when they've got a film like that, like something you are interested in coming out, they'll send you an email, not everybody an email.
Our producer, Brendan P.W. McDonald, he swears by it. You know, I've not got on board with it. I guess I better because I don't.
It's really terrific. They send you for a certain fee. You get sent the films that you request. There's no late fees. You send it back when you want. And then it's all they take care of all the postage for you. It's really cool.
So dig this. So Jane Fonda, her new movie Monster in Law is being banned at an owner of a theater owner in Kentucky because of what she did during the Vietnam War. This crap still exists. It still exists. These people are out there, man. And apparently there's a list. There's somebody who has a website that makes a list of movie personalities that are on the wrong side of things and to be boycotted. And you've made the list, and Susan Sarandon has made the list.
Yeah,
there you go.
You made an impact out there, man.
See? You know, it's all... I would bet you that man calls himself a Christian, too.
Of course. A Christian that says, hate these people in the name of Jesus.
Hate these people and never forgive. Never forgive.
Because that's what Jesus was about. Only we know that. You know, we're reading into it. So are you going to go see the new Star Wars?
I'm going to take
the fifth.
Be diplomatic.
Wow.
I assume you're going to go see War of the Worlds because you're in that one.
I'm going to see that many, many times.
Have you seen it cut yet? Have you?
I've only seen, you know, he's just finishing it now. I mean, no one's seen it.
That would be Steven Spielberg?
Yeah. And I saw a little bit in looping, but... But that was it.
How's it look? Does it look all Spielberg-y and stuff?
It looks really cool.
I've
seen some of the effects that, you know, in the shots that he had done previous to when I worked on the thing. It's really, really big. And
yeah. Let me get back to this theater thing, because something sparked me when you said that, you know, the group, your theater, the Actors Gang, is, you want to take a sort of punk rock sensibility to the stage and really confront stuff with that sort of ideology. Now, in terms of theater groups, because there's been many, there's been the Living Theater, there's been the Group Theater, there's a history of politically active and sort of avant-garde and button-pushing groups of theater. What did you model yours after? Do you have an appreciation of that history?
Well, I came up in the theater in Manhattan in the 70s and doing this kind of mobile theater, street theater. We'd pack a truck and we'd go off in the different neighborhoods and do different vaudevilles about what was going on.
Was that Julian Beck sing?
No. That was called the Theater for the New City.
Okay.
And it was summer program.
Yeah.
And they've done it for years and years. And it was really a great way to learn how to act. A lot of distraction on the street, and you have to learn how to focus.
They were based on 4th Street? Was that? No, that was...
They were there on, they're on 11th Avenue,
okay.
And 1st Avenue now.
Yeah.
When I was with them, they were on Jane Street.
Oh, okay.
And, it was, you know, it was great training, but it was also my idea of it was that you were informed and you did theater about something.
Yeah.
And I did meet Julian Beck and Judith Malina, and
that was the Living Theater, right?
Yeah.
And they came. Judith came. Julian's been dead for a few years, but Judith came with a friend to Embedded and was just glowing about it afterwards, which was a great.
It's exciting when you get that respect from the people that are respected.
Yes, it was a really nice legitimization.
We're talking to Tim Robbins, Embedded, his rock and roll performance piece with many people of the Actors Gang involved.
It's not performance art.
No, I said piece.
Okay.
There you go. His punk theater manifesto is available on DVD on May 31st. You can go to embeddedlive.com for more info. Do you want to hang out? We got this guy.
I want to find out about
Disneyland?
About Jigger.
All right, Tyler Gray.
I want to know which one is the biggest deviant.
He's going to reveal. Tyler Gray, a contributing writer for the new magazine Radar, is going to talk to us about what's really going on at Disneyland. I love hearing this stuff because apparently there's a certain leniency. There's rules within Disneyland. And this stuff takes place at housing. There's Disneyland housing for the employees that work there that are supposedly just sort of like, woohoo, let's go. You know, like
after hours.
It's after hours.
So it's not,
not a ride at the park.
All right.
Wait a minute. How nice can the housing be? They're only paying most of these guys $6.50 an hour.
So it could be very nice. Because obviously
or
it's not
like
going to be
housing
employed
in the mining towns of the early 20th century.
I hope he knows something about Disney Jail because I want to know what goes on in there.
I'm sure he will. So we'll be talking to him. That's Tyler Gray coming up next here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
Tim Robbins is here. You can go to embeddedlive.com for info on his new rock and roll, exciting piece of, it's not theater, it's something you've never seen before. It's available on DVD May 31st. There'll be more of the worlds that's coming out eventually from Steven Spielberg. And right now, have you ever wondered what Mickey, Goofy, Pluto, and other Disney characters do when the workday ends? Our next guest unmasks the long-suffering, hard-drinking, cross-dressing denizens of Disney World in his article in the premier issue of Radar Magazine, which will be available on newsstands on May 24th. Welcome to the show, Tyler Gray.
Thanks, gentlemen.
Welcome to the Morning Sedition Party.
Yeah.
Big fans. So, you guys started.
So, thanks. Dude, I read this piece, and set it up a little bit. You worked at Disney?
No, I didn't work at Disney, but I grew up in Orlando.
Okay.
Kind of like working for Disney. I mean, you mentioned the company town concept of mining towns where you live and work in the same place. Orlando has kind of that vibe, and everybody knows, the girl I went to the prom with in, 10th grade, she was a dancer at Disney.
A dancer at Disney.
And later at Vegas.
So she stuck with it, the entertainment field.
Exactly.
So now, you knew Plutos and Goofies and Mickeys and...
A Goofy was a good friend of mine. we called him Goofy.
So you called him Goofy out of the costume. I guess that's going to stick.
Yeah, huh? That was his nickname in high school. I mean, it's deep within the culture of Florida.
Now, I didn't know. Yeah, my buddy Todd grew up in Florida, and he actually does this bit about where he says a friend of his says, "Yeah, I don't go to Disney World, man. It's too touristy." He goes, "Really? The tourists found out about Disney World? That used to be our own special little place." That's Todd Barry's joke. So tell me now, I didn't realize until I read your piece that they actually have housing for the employees.
Yeah, at Disney World in Florida, just maybe a mile or so off of campus, off of the park, there's this place called Vista Way, and it's one of about three or four places where the college program students can come and live, actually, in Disney contracted housing. The pay comes right out of their paycheck, so they never have to worry. I mean, the rent comes right out of their paycheck, so they never have to worry about paying rent or having, too much real responsibility.
Wow, can they only use Disney money?
No, they're just a step away from minting their own coins. So these guys, they go to work. They come back, and there's just a raging party just about every night in this housing complex. It's called Vista Way, but the nickname is Vista Lay.
Oh, ooh, man. All right, so what goes on? What goes on?
I mean, just imagine, a fraternity and a sorority combined where, the front door is always open on people's places, and, you might have five girls living across from five guys, and it's like... The Real World Uncensored.
But do they come with their suits? I mean, do they have
there's some swiping of costume pieces here and there that happens.
But, is there literally moments where someone says, no, put on the head. I want you to do it with the head on.
I wasn't able to experience that particular thing. I heard stories, and there's a quote in there, which I can't really repeat on the air, but it's about Cinderella and her prowess in a certain sexual...
Nice. I think fellatio is okay.
Yeah, Cinderella gets great.
What was the weirdest pairing?
I mean, I want to know.
Pairing of characters, actually.
Goofy or being Goofy.
Pooh and...
But you actually said that they defied each other in a way that it was sort of... These were legitimate sex parties. That they were saying you had to sort of swap partners and sort of, try to have sex with as many people as possible and whatnot.
I mean... There's a ton of legend out there about these characters and what they do. There is. You get inside these circles and inside these heads of Disney characters, and you start hearing about parties where everybody's kind of making out with somebody else, and it's a Halloween party, and the costumes come out, and people are in drag, and it sounds like something that's would happen at the Grotto. I mean, it can really sound pretty intense.
And Disney's freaked out about, like, they really protect the identity and the reputation of their characters. That was a fascinating thing.
Which is pretty much what this story is about. I mean, the idea here is that this is a company that holds such a tight reins on their employees that the natural reaction, the equal and opposite reaction, is for them to cut loose like maniacs and get off the clock, And the more they can bend and break these little laws, the more they can snatch back little pieces of their own personality that they give up on a daily basis for this job.
No, I mean, from reading the piece, it sounds as though a lot of these kids are actually programmed, I mean, in terms of the persona that they adopt when they get into the outfits.
Right.
How deep is that?
Well, I mean, they go through an intense kind of, an audition. It's like American Idol. I sort of compared it to that, but not...
$6.50 an hour?
Yeah.
I don't think
exactly.
So.
Well, 300 kids show up and start applying for these, very few jobs that are available, And by the end of the day, maybe a couple dozen have been selected to be these characters. But from then on, it just goes into like a week-long sort of training/indoctrination or whatever you want to call it, into how Disney behaves, how a Disney employee looks, how they, move or point or talk or don't talk if they're in the character costume. It's a real deep kind of, cultural embedment that they have to go through to get out in the park.
But some people, it's their goal. They're not trying to get into movies. They're not trying to get into television. They want to be a Disney character. And that's another theme throughout the piece, is that the adulation that they receive, they're hooked on it. That one of the reasons a lot of these people do it is to be a god of children.
Right. James Stewart, who wrote the Disney War book, which was a great book, he got to put on that costume, the Goofy costume. Mm-hmm. It was just something I would have loved to have done, but maybe I need to win a Pulitzer first. But he put on the costume, and as critical he was of Eisner and everybody involved, he said, when you put that costume on and a kid comes up and hugs your leg like it's the best thing that ever happened to him in his entire life, it all melts away. Like, all the cynicism melts away.
Uh-huh.
And that's what these kids are after, or the kids who go work there are after. They want to be stars, in the simplest way possible.
So they're hooked on the love the kids have for the characters, and they just sort of transfer that onto themselves. And
yeah, it's kind of a little
creepy. We got a caller from who says he worked at Disneyland. Mark, what's going on? You got any info for us?
I can't get over you talking about this. This is hysterical. I was an Imagineer there back in the early 70s when they built Space Mountain.
You created rides?
Yeah, I worked at the rides when I was in Disney back then. I was one of the first interns there.
Okay.
I was 19 when I was working there, and I was at the University of Florida.
Good time.
And I went out, I dated Cinderella because... Let me tell you something. When the first time I ever ran into gay people was in Disney. The greatest thing that happened there was that there were so many gay people working there that there was no competition. So I had the time of my life with these girls. And I mean, the funny thing is when he's talking about pairing up, we used to have a joke that the tour guy, at the time the tour guys only went out with the guys in the Jungle Cruise. That was the way. It was like and the cheerleaders, because the Jungle Cruise was the one that you could do. You could ad lib on and stuff like that. So it was like your ride that you could go on.
Uh-huh.
But I dressed as Pluto. They let me. What happened was I befriended when I was working. When you're 19, you have nothing else to do there but just have a good time. So I would go after, at the end of the day, after I've done, working in the office, I was in the basement down below the park. That's where we used to work, was underneath the whole theme park. There was a whole city underneath there.
Yeah.
So I would work down below Main Street. I'd go upstairs, and they would let me dress up as, and like if they needed an extra costume, I dressed up as Winnie the Pooh, and I dressed up as Pluto. And the guy's right. When you put on let me tell you something, there's nothing like when you get inside one of those costumes, your whole identity gets lost. And you can become something else. And when you have a kid come up to you in a wheelchair or some old person, and it really is an unbelievable feeling. And that's what it is. So a lot of kids there, they want to go into, look at all the kids that are like Britney Spears and all of them. You start off dancing.
Yeah, look at that.
On the stage. That's what you end up wanting to do, is like you do a theme song there. But So what is this guy, wrote a book or something about this?
Not yet. It's on the way.
No. It's an article in the new Radar magazine.
Right, Radar.
Thanks for the call, Mark. Good talking to you.
I was going to ask that guy if he ever saw anybody do anything in the costume, like, you know, take drugs or anything like that.
Well, you have some. You've reported on that. There was a tripping poo episode.
There's this legendary story about this tripping poo in Disneyland on the West Coast. In Anaheim, you know. There's a guy who actually did a play about it out there, and this was one of the scenes.
The Tripping Poo?
Yeah. I love that band. But that'd be pretty good.
Great name.
So this guy, you know, he said, everybody knew that this guy was kind of a crazy case, and he apparently dropped acid right before he put on the poo costume and went out in the park. And he ended up falling down this flight of stairs with poo. And, you know, he was ushered out of sight of the guests, you know, obviously. And
had the crap kicked out of him.
Yeah. And I think they put on, like, some Pink Floyd and you know, like Dark Side of the Moon. And he came down, he mellowed out a little bit, yeah. But, no, the thing is about that is they can't, I mean, it's hard to tell if the guy's just heat.
Whoops.
It's all right.
We're talking to Tyler Gray. He's got a piece in the premier issue of Radar magazine. It's called Wild Kingdom. Now, the other interesting thing is that when you document a few episodes of drugs, but apparently because these costumes get so hot and these guys are sweating so much that, you know, heat exhaustion, and if you're hungover, you know, just that kind of delirium fits in. So they don't always take, reprisals? Is that the word I'm looking for? They don't punish these guys. There's policy that says they'll get fired, but you can't tell the difference.
Right. I mean, how do you know if somebody's still buzzed from the night before, whether they're suffering from 120 degrees inside the costume and about to pass out? I mean, it's a thin line. So, yeah, Disney has a policy to fire anybody who's on drugs, obviously, but how do you tell? You know, you're putting these people in tough situations, you know, and they probably just were out the night before going nuts. So.
And also some of the stuff that I imagine has been documented before that I haven't seen is that they monitor these people, that you can't go in between different sections of the park. You have people that are undercover watching to see if these people are signing enough autographs or handling the kids properly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, I mean, they will actually go out. They have these people called greeters,
mm-hmm.
who will actually go out with the characters. They're kind of minding, you know, their behavior and make sure they don't do anything wrong and making sure that the guests don't harass them too much. And they'll actually hide behind trees or something and watch these guys do their job and
wow.
make sure they're not, you know, talking in character or doing anything at all that that doesn't fit the character.
Tim Robbins, have you brought your kids to Disney World or Disneyland?
Oh, yeah, we always go there, but we're always tripping.
I'm going.
Family experience.
I'm going next month, and I'm tempted, I'll tell you. It's starting to scare me. When we come back, I want to find out about the article says it's like a pecking order with regard to the different characters. What is it, like 1,200 characters or something?
You know, they never gave me a hard, fast number, and Disney's real reluctant to talk about that at all, but it's like 5,000 people who probably play some character or another, just at Disney World. So.
Wow. So yeah. Okay. So next up, we'll talk a little bit more about that. We'll take a call or two. We got Tim Robbins in the house. The DVD of Embedded available at embeddedlive.com. We got Tyler Gray here, Wild Kingdom, the article in the premier issue of Radar magazine. It's a party in here. It's 46 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Y'all ready for this?
Hi, this is Charles Barkley, and you're listening to Mark Maron and Mark Riley. Anything less would be uncivilized. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Call us at 866-303-2270. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Yes, it is. It's much more than we ever thought.
Oh, yeah.
51 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Tim Robbins is here. His show, that's all I'm going to say, his rock and roll show. Embedded will be released on DVD on May 31st. You can go to embeddedlive.com for info. Also in studio, Tyler Gray, his article, Wild Kingdom, about the secrets sexual insanity behind the scenes at Disney World in Florida will be in Radar Magazine's premiere issue, which is out when?
It's out May 24th.
Okay, if you want to... No, that's good. Podcast Morning's Edition. You can go to Morning's Edition. MorningsEdition.com for details. Now, you just had a kid, right,
yes,
Tyler?
I did. Thank
Congratulations.
God.
Congratulations.
Thank God I married a woman who knows
how to have
a kid. Perfect woman, yeah.
Don't they all innately know that on some level?
Yeah.
My son
Goofy was born.
I got to ask you about this pecking order thing.
Oh, yeah, pecking order.
There is a pecking order, right?
There is. I mean, if you play Goofy, you're higher on the pecking order than if you're Mr. Smee or, you know, some minor character.
I don't even know who Smee is.
Exactly, yeah, right. And most kids don't, so they don't get the juice, you know. But if you're a face character, meaning you look like Pocahontas or you look like, you know, Cinderella or Snow White, then you're at the top of the heap because you don't have to wear the mask. You get to be more of an actor, occasionally improv a line or two. And it's a big deal, just like the caller was saying, to be able to break a little bit out of that, you know, real tight Disney mold.
Okay. Let's take a couple of Disney calls. We got a couple of Disney-related calls. Susie.
Disney's lawyer's on the phone right now.
Yeah, right. Susie in Orlando, what's up?
Hey.
Okay, back in the early 70s, we were...
This is already good. Okay, what happened?
Those of us who worked at the Polynesian Hotel Luau, it was really, really, really hot. And in the middle of the night, the girls and some of the guys would jump into the Seven Seas Lagoon skinny dipping.
Uh-huh. Ooh. And?
Okay, and I have a better story.
Uh-huh.
Back in the early 70s, Rock Hudson would show up as a narrator for the Candlelight Processional, which is the Christmas program. And then that's when all of Disney World employees found out he was gay because he was hitting on all of the employees everywhere he went.
Ah.
Really, really drunk. Everybody was having a very good time.
Drunk Rock
Hudson. Yeah.
So that was an interesting. Thank you for your call, Susie. That was an interesting part of the article as well, is that I guess one in four performers at Disneyland are gay.
I mean, that's a rough estimate. I mean, they don't do a survey, but I think that's a real fair number or a real safe number. It might be even more than that. And it's one of the, you know, kind of great little bastions of equality in Florida, where it's like, you know, here's this place that was one of the first companies of its size to allow, you know, extend health benefits to domestic partners. And yeah, so it created this environment of you know, sort of open whatever.
We got another call. John, listening to 1190 WLIB in Brooklyn. What do you got?
Hi. Also, yeah, really back in the early 70s when within the first year that the park was opened, I had a friend, a lover of mine, who was a construction worker on high-rise construction in New York City. And I was 28 years old, and we couldn't get the employees off of us and from inviting themselves back to our hotel room.
Was this Disney World or Fire Island?
It was Disney World in their polyester suits.
It was a Fire Island ride. Thanks a lot, John.
Does James Dobson know about this stuff? Tony Perkins from the Family Resource Council? I mean, I'm surprised.
Yeah, focus on the family. Yeah, actually, they know about Disney, you know, and the sort of gay population very well, because every year there's Gay Days at Disney, which is like 100,000 or so, you know, gay people show up and celebrate sort of being out in the open and wear matching red T-shirts and sort of take over the park in a really kind of cool way. So, yeah, I mean, Disney knows that Southern Baptists are there, you know.
Always the corporate policy with gays has always been very generous and very open and very progressive.
That's a good thing.
It is a good thing.
All right, Tyler Gray, the article is Wild Kingdom. It's in the premier issue of Radar Magazine. Look for that, and congratulations on the birth of your son. His name is really...
Cash Michael.
Yeah. Cash Michael.
All right, Tim Robbins, Embedded, the rock and roll masterpiece on DVD, May 31st. And go to embeddedlive.com and also look for Tim in War of the Worlds. Thank you guys for coming. I appreciate you being here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right now, for those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for another edition of today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. A telephone company promotes anti-gay agenda. Are you paying too much for long distance? How about sodomy? United American Technologies is a phone company that is promoting itself as one that does not condone the homosexual lifestyle. And three-way calling? Forget about it! School teachers in India are told to cover up with aprons or students so students don't get distracted. It's vitally important that young people in India get a decent education or customer support lines in the U.S. will have no qualified operators. Ellen DeGeneres, here we go. Ellen DeGeneres says she was molested as a teen. How much longer will this arrogant woman try to usurp the reign of Oprah as the most molested daytime TV host?
That's
all right. Today's phrase, just drop it into conversation, screw Frist. North Korea is about to exercise the nuclear option, too. Wake up, sheeple. The Armageddon show is in previews. Those are your morning sedition cliff notes for today. What do we got tomorrow, Mark Riley?
Well, the editors of Heave Magazine are going to be here. They're going to be here to talk about the big book of Jewish conspiracy.
I'm part of that. I'm on that list.
Yeah, he's on it. You are on that list. Yeah. Will Durst is going to be here. Comic extraordinaire.
From San Francisco. Very funny. Up in Boston this week at Jimmy Tingle's Off-Broadway Theater up there.
And we've got Rapture Watch with Cardinal Melfington.
And Cardinal's always
my
entertaining.
Favorite. Yeah.
Well, thanks for being here, Tim.
Thanks
Tyler.
A lot, folks.
Thanks.
Good seeing
right.
you, Riley. Good show.
Good see. Yeah, we've had a ball, man. We're going to do it all again tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. Eastern.
Sure.
Live on Air America Radio. We'll be right back.